the removal of sanctions, calling the sanctions a crime and treason against the Iranian people. Supporting Iran's decision to roll back its commitments, he said. When the other side does not implement any of its commitments, there's no point for Iran to fulfill all of its commitments, adding, if they return to the commitments, we will do the same. The leader further pointed to Iran's regional presence, stressing Iran will continue to reinforce its regional allies. Ayatollah Khamenei referred to the recent chaos in the U.S. and said Washington is always after creating instability in other countries, and now it's happened on its own soil.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, came down hard on the United States and its allies over their years-long sanctions against the Iranian people. Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that the measures are based on a baseless animosity and have to be lifted right away. Iran's leader noted that setting conditions for the removal of sanctions is nonsense. He said a possible U.S. return to the 2015 nuclear deal would be meaningless if the sanctions stay in place. Ayatollah Khamenei threw his weight behind the recent move by the Iranian government to scale down its commitments under the deal known as the JCPOA, saying that Tehran will not accept any obligations without reciprocal measures, adding that it would be meaningless for the Islamic Republic to implement all its commitments under the JCPOA when the other side implements almost none of its. Ayatollah Khamenei slammed comments made by some Western countries over Iran's regional policies. He stressed that Tehran will continue to play its role for regional stability, like its recent contribution to Iraq and Syria that led to the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group there. The Iran leader said that it is the U.S. that finds its interest in destabilizing the region, noting that such plots have been explicitly stated by some American thinkers, including someone from the American Enterprise Institute. Speaking on Iran's defense capabilities, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the country is strong enough now to deter a war similar to the one launched by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein with arms and backing of the West in the 1980s. Iran's leader then touched upon recent developments surrounding the U.S. presidential election, saying the so-called American values and democracy have turned into a laughingstock even among American friends. He said what happened in Washington, D.C. was the very thing Americans were planning to incite in Iran over a decade ago.
Joining us on this debate, we have political analyst Mr. John Bosnich joining us from New York, also from the Iranian capital, Tehran. We have journalist and commentator Mostafa Khoshchesh. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with our guest in Tehran, Mr. Khoshchesh. Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says the Islamic Republic is not in a rush for the U.S. to return to the 2015 nuclear deal. Does that indicate, in your opinion, that the so-called maximum pressure campaign has failed to achieve its goals?
Hello, Barry. Yeah, thanks for having me. Well, true. Maximum pressure policy failed back in May when even former National Security Advisor of the United States, John Bolton, admitted that pressures had failed to substitute Iran, and then they changed Brian Hooks, who was in charge of the Iran dossier or Iran's policy in the U.S. Administration. It's no secret that the U.S. needs to change a strategy, but it's pretty well understood that the U.S. would continue the same containment strategy that started under President Obama. And President Trump never, went astray much. Actually, he also resorted to this strategy, continued this strategy that works through sanctions and posing credible military threat alongside other threats, cyber attacks, and so on and so forth, in order to pressure Tehran into talks. Then as a result of talks, they won several agreements on Iran's missile program, regional power, the future of Iran's nuclear industries, human rights, guaranteeing Israel security, and many other issues, as even President-elect Biden has said. So the two sides are now at a war of willpower, and Tehran says that despite what they think, that Iran is an urgent need for a removal of sanctions, and Iran is in a rush. Tehran is in no rush. Actually, Tehran has just started, maximizing its efforts and plan under the resistance support the active resistance strategy, you know, at a time when the United States' maximum pressure is going down in terms of its effects and impacts and results, and the pressures would lower down and decrease. As we've seen, Iran has been exporting crude to Venezuela. 10 Iranian ships are said to be on the way to Venezuela carrying petrol and other petroleum products. And Iran, at such a juncture, Iran has just started increasing its pressures on the United States, and the start of 20% enrichment, uranium enrichment, is just one of the Iranian pressure leverages. So
the
time now works. Time now works in Iran's interest, I believe.
Let's get in word from our guest in New York. Mr. Bosnich, Ayatollah Khamenei says Iran's logical demand is the removal of sanctions. He says that's the right of the Iranian people, which has been stolen. Well, after that, a U.S. return would make sense. What is your perspective on those comments?
Well, first I'd like to reinforce the position of your other guest today. The sanctions have proven to be ineffective completely, as they generally and usually are. People need to remember that more than half of this planet is almost continuously under United States imperial sanctions. It's not just Iran, it's Russia, it's China, in some parts it's India, it's parts of Africa, it's parts of South America. In fact, my native Canada has actually come under U.S. trade restrictions in the past. So the tactic of people-directed, in other words, because sanctions actually hit the normal people, people-directed sanctions is almost always a failure. And it develops hatred towards the United States by the victim peoples. So that tactic does not work. It's been proven time and time again. But it's a way to keep the warmongers happy in the Pentagon that something is being done. So that's the first starting point. Now, when we go ahead to the question of Iran's logical demands, every country in world has something that's called sovereignty. That means independence and freedom at the state level. We live in a very unbalanced world. We have a few countries which are exorbitantly rich. We have many countries which are extremely poor. And then we have states that are in the middle, like Iran and various other countries, which have great potential to advance if they're given a fair chance in competition. It is logical that Iran, as a country, Iran is a historic world-leading country. So it is only logical and natural and a necessary exercise of sovereignty for Iran to develop its science and technology, to develop its national defense. I mean, Iran has been bombed by Israel in peacetime. So Iran has these inherent rights, and these rights are not just something special for Iran. They're guaranteed under the UN Charter, and in fact, the United Nations is supposed to intervene in Iran's favor if anyone violates Iran's sovereignty. So I would say that not only has the sovereignty of Iran been infringed upon through these coercive techniques of sanctions, but Iran has to be credited for having immense patience, given the fact that the American side withdrew from a treaty which it dictated to Iran.
Sure.
This is not a complex story, and people who claim to not understand Iran's position must not be trumped.
Okay, Mr. Khoshesh, on the JCPOA, Iran, it's time and again said, if the U.S. doesn't implement its commitments, and it's not just the U.S., it's the E3 signatories as well, it would be meaningless for Iran to implement its part of the deal. This stance against Iran, it's always been inconsistent and hypocritical, hasn't it?
Ah, yes, true. You know, this is not the first time that Iran and the Europeans or the United States have struck deal. There have been so many agreements between the two sides, at least four or five in the past 20 years. And in all these cases, Tehran has been in compliance with the, has held up the, its end of the bargain, and the other side has defied the terms of the agreement. One of the best known cases was back in 2004 to 2006 when Iran struck three separate agreements over its nuclear industries with the three European states, and Iran was acknowledged by the Europeans as well as the IAEA to be in full compliance with the agreements, with its undertakings under these three agreements. But at the end of the day, the Europeans told Tehran when they were asked to comply with their promises and with their undertakings, they said that they cannot do anything because they don't have the permission of the United States, and they told Tehran to go and talk with the United States, and eventually everything, collapsed, all the three agreements, because they never complied with their undertakings. One of those agreements pertained to the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. It was it started in the last 2 years of President Khatami, the reformist president, and at the end of his presidency, when they defied their undertakings, he himself restarted, ordered the resumption of Iran's nuclear activities and the end of the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol, which happens to be one of the main merits of the deal for the United States and the IAEA and the Europeans, even under the JCPOA, because it's true that Iran stayed loyal to the nuclear deal for quite a long time, but after 14 months after the United States withdrew from the deal and the Europeans never complied with their promises, Tehran started modifying its undertakings, but not all its undertakings. Iran is still complying with one-third of its commitments. That includes the additional protocol to the NPT. Iran is fulfilling it on a voluntary basis. Iran has warned, according to a parliament approval, which was ratified a few weeks ago, they have warned that if the Europeans continue the same case, if the U.S. defies its undertakings, then the same experience would repeat itself. Like 2006, Iran would stop the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. So there is going to be much cost if the Europeans and Americans do not fulfill their promises and defy their undertakings.
Mr. Bosnich, I believe we lost that connection. I'm going to address that question to you as well, Mr. Khoshesh. Ayatollah Khamenei has also spoke about Iran's regional presence in his latest address. He said, unlike the U.S. and other foreign presences in the region, Tehran has helped improve regional security, and Iran will continue reinforcing its regional friends. Now, we've seen that with the fight against Daesh and other Takfiri terrorist groups. Who exactly, can you tell us, feels threatened by Iran's regional influence and presence?
Sure, Israel, but let's remember that many Europeans should be thankful, even American people, average citizens, they should be thankful to martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, the two martyrs in the Iranian IRGC, Quds Force Anti-Terrorism Units, as well as the popular forces who fought Daesh that was created by the United States allies. If it hadn't been for their efforts, then these militants, these terrorists, would have been killing Europeans in the undergrounds, in Brussels, in Paris, in London, in everywhere, in Spain, Madrid, in the United States, as they did on several occasions. But they stopped because they were hunted down by this man, by Haj Qasem Soleimani, the lieutenant general. If the United States and its allies can never deny the very clear-cut facts that they were in charge of creating Daesh, they have admitted that, they have acknowledged that, and I've repeatedly been saying, because I do not want this to be forgotten by the people in the West, that General Michael Flynn, that General Dempsey, who was the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff of the United States, Jake Sullivan, who's now the National Security Advisor, and many others, Hillary Clinton, and many others, they have admitted that it was the United States ally, main ally, Saudi Arabia, as well as a number of others, like Qatar and Turkey. They started this mess in the Middle East, and they trained, they supported, and they created Daesh. And according to General Michael Flynn, who told Al Jazeera in America that after he was the head of the Pentagon Intelligence Department, he said that we knew Daesh was being created by our allies in eastern Syria and western Iraq, but we took no action. We informed the Obama White House, not the Trump, but Obama White House, and we never took any action because they wanted to destabilize the region, according to the book, according to the confession made by Michael Levin in his book
Mr. Hoshesh, I'm sorry I'm going to interrupt you there. We've got our guest, Mr. Bosnich. Back from New York, Mr. Bosnich, Tehran says the interests of the U.S. and its allies are rooted in regional stability. An individual by the name of Michael Arthur Ladin, who's a former consultant to the United States National Security Council, United States Department of State, and the United States Department of Defense, who is with the American Enterprise Institute, he says in one of his books that, quote, a stability is an unworthy American mission and a misleading concept, too. We do not want stability in Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and even Saudi Arabia. We want things to change. The real issue is not whether, but how to destabilize. Why is instability in the region the method of choice for the United States?
It's not just in the Iran region. My paternal ancestors came from the former Yugoslavia, and that obviously is a picture of what the United States does to a region, ripping apart stable countries, arming multiple sides in conflicts, disrupting interhuman relations in a region, of course starting with trade embargoes. How does this serve the United States? Well, we've got to stop talking about the United States here. It doesn't serve the United States. It doesn't serve the people of America. What it does is it serves the ruling clique that runs America. That's the concept that people don't discuss. You know, having grown up until my late 20s in Canada, just an hour's drive from the American border, Canada is considered quite a weak power beside America. But even we have been on the receiving end of American economic and political pressures. They interfere in our political system. They interfere in our economic system. They, you know, maybe people in Iran don't know this. In major centers in Canada, we have 70 to 80 or maybe even 100 television stations available over cable and over satellite. More than 5% of those television and radio stations as well are all from America. So we are being propagandized and gradually turned into Americans. We speak the same language. We have similar standards for automobiles and lifestyle. And actually, we're being assimilated the peaceful way. If we were to resist the use of our resources, as Iran has resisted the unpaid use of its oil resources for decades, we would be the subject of the same kind of actions as Iran has been subjected to. Coup d'etats, foreign control over regimes, and so on. So this has to be perceived not in the perspective of a battle between the people of Iran and the people of America. It's not. I personally, as a Canadian who I worked in Japan for 20 years, I was the advisor to the Japanese Prime Minister's office. I, in Japan, as a journalist, worked together with very close and trustworthy, open Iranian friends who told me firsthand about what it's like in your country. So I can tell you that you are not alone. Okay. And what you are going through is the kind of things that many of us go through, but not at the level that you've been subjected to.
All right, thanks a lot. Sorry to interrupt you there. We're short of time for tonight's program. I'd like to thank my guest, political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from New York. Also, thanks to journalist and commentator Mostafa Hoshchesh, speaking to us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also, special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. And so those who were given knowledge may know that it is the truth from your Lord, and therefore believe in it, and their hearts humbly submit to it. And indeed is Allah the guide of those who have believed to a straight path.
After talking about the 53rd verse, we can now move on to the next. The Almighty Allah starts saying, وَلِيَعْلَمَ الَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْعِلْمَ أَنَّهُ الْحَقُّ مِنْ رَبِّكَ, and that those who have been given the knowledge may know that it is the truth from your Lord. فَيُؤْمِنُوا بِهِ فَتُخْبِتَ لَهُ قُلُوبُهُمْ, so that they may believe in it and their hearts may be lowly before it. وَإِنَّ اللَّهَ لَهَادِ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا إِلَىٰ صِرَاطٍ مُسْتَقِيمٍ, and verily, Allah guides those who believe onto a straight path. The Holy Quran in this verse implies that the purpose of this event is that those who are there and, of course, knowledgeable and can recognize will truly know right from wrong, and they will be able to separate the divine programs from the satanic temptations, and comparing them with each other, they will know that the religion of Allah is the truth, and the religion of Allah has come from the side of the Lord, and since it has come from Him, they can believe in it, and they can make their hearts humble before it. The verse says, وَلِيَعْلَمَ الَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْعِلْمَ أَنَّهُ الْحَقُّ مِنْ رَبِّكَ, so that those who have been given the knowledge may know that it is the truth from your Lord. فَيُؤْمِنُوا بِهِ فَتُخْبِتَ لَهُمْ قُلُوبُهُمْ, so they may believe in it and their hearts may be lowly before it. So these satanic temptations, it is really interesting that for the people who are the people of knowledge, who are knowledgeable and are able to recognize the truth from the wrong, the temptations are just kind of root for their more knowledge. These temptations will prove for these knowledgeable people that it is only the Allah which is the truth. But for those who are actually blind, are hard-hearted and sick-hearted, these temptations will be fitna, and they will not pass this trial.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So, the true knowledge coming from the side of Allah is a blessing, and we should ask for this blessing in our supplications. The verse says, وَلْيَعْلَمَ الَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْعِلْمَ. It doesn't say, وَلْيَعْلَمَ الَّذِينَ عَلِمُوا. These people were given the knowledge. The knowledge has come from the side of the Almighty Allah, so it is an actual blessing. And of course, those people who are the true people of knowledge shouldn't be from the hard-hearted people. They shouldn't be sick-hearted, because in the previous verse it says fi qulubihim marad, and in this verse it says utul ilma. These people are the opposite of the previous side. So the true knowledge is the one that doesn't make you hard-hearted and sick-hearted. Of course, when some dangerous thing come in the way of these believers who are truth-seekers, Allah does not leave them alone. He will be their support, but He guides those who believe towards the straight path. In other words, because of their faith, He subhanahu wa ta'ala guides them to paradise, which is the very straight path. The verse says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَهَادِ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا إِلَىٰ صِرَاطٍ مُسْتَقِيمٍ. And verily, Allah guides those who believe onto a straight path. So this verse talks about the different stages of true being in the way and path of man's life. First, you need knowledge. لِيَعْلَمَ الَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْعِلْمَ أَنَّهُ الْحَقُّ مِنْ رَبِّكَ فَيُؤْمِنُوا. And that those who have been given the knowledge may know that it is truth from your Lord, and it means that they may believe. So the second step and stage is believing, and the third stage is what we call khudur, and it's called being lowly and submit to the Almighty Allah. And whoever starts this path, Almighty Allah will help him and support him to get to the higher levels. Because the very verse says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَهَادِ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا إِلَىٰ صِرَاطٍ مُسْتَقِيمٍ. So, if you take a step towards the Almighty Allah, He will take more steps and He will give you more help and support. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Don't be
saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. When faith begins.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Round the world with reporters.
Outgoing US President Donald Trump has finally declared there will be an orderly transition of power. The news comes after violence in the nation's capital as Trump supporters stormed the Capitol building while lawmakers met to certify President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. World leaders joined the chorus of outrage condemning the outgoing president for stoking the unrest. For weeks he undermined the result, claiming election fraud, and then rallied protesters to head to the Capitol. As angry demonstrators stormed Congress, one woman was shot dead by police and three others died of, quote, medical emergencies. An improvised explosive device was also intercepted by authorities. As the situation deteriorated, fellow Republicans urged Trump to call his protest off. Hours later, he posted a video reiterating his claims of fraud. He also cheered his supporters, saying he loved them and described them as special, but called on them to remain calm and return home. In an unprecedented step, Twitter took down the video and suspended his account, threatening permanent suspension if he continued to violate the social media platform. President of the European Council, Charles Michel, took to Twitter to voice his concerns. He joined world leaders calling for a peaceful transfer of power. Earlier, UK Home Secretary Priti Patel was asked about Trump's role in stoking anger and mistrust in the electoral process.
We've just seen, you know, confidence in democracy being shattered, quite frankly, and there's no justification for the level of violence, full stop, that was on show and has been on display. And people have been assaulted, people have died. The violence, you know, should stop, and he should absolutely condemn everything that has taken place.
In the early hours, Republican Senator Mitt Romney blamed President Trump for inciting a violent insurrection. He also downplayed suggestions of a congressional audit to placate angry Trump supporters.
For any who remain insistent on an audit in order to satisfy the many people who believe that the election was stolen, I'd offer this perspective. No congressional audit is ever going to convince these voters, particularly when the president will continue to say that the election was stolen.
Many predicted unrest, but Wednesday's scenes went beyond expectation. Four people dead, with lawmakers having to cower and abandon the historic building. In less than 2 weeks, President-elect Joe Biden will be inaugurated in the very same building, but with scenes of unrest, authorities will be bracing for more potential chaos, as the world watches the most powerful nation descend into even greater levels of division.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a name that defined Iran's nuclear energy program. The top Iranian nuclear scientist was assassinated in November last year. In terms of who was behind the incident, Iran has from the outset pointed the finger at Israel. Israel has a track record of killing Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. Fakhrizadeh is the fifth to be targeted. While Iran has revealed that it has tracked down some of those involved in the attack, families of the slain nuclear scientists have separately initiated a lawsuit at Iran's Court for International Affairs, not against Israel, but against the United States, for, quote, systemic support for Israel's terrorist activities against Iran. The lead lawyer of the lawsuit says if the case is certified, Iran can freeze American assets in some countries and transfer them as compensation to the families of the victims.
The families of the slain scientists demand that the masterminds of the attacks be punished. Iran does not recognize Israel as a country, so we filed a lawsuit against the U.S. as the major supporter of Israel's crimes. The case will be reviewed at Iran's Court for International Affairs, and then we will take further legal proceedings at an international scale. This is to relieve part of the pain inflicted on the families of the victims.
Iran says the assassination of its scientists pursues a single goal, to deal a heavy blow to the country's nuclear program. But the emotional side effects are even heavier to bear for the families of the victims, like 14-year-old Armita, who lost her father when she was only four. She says she will never forgive those who took away her dream. Israel has not commented on any of the assassinations of the Iranian scientists. But as to the last one, it has already spilled the beans on itself. Fakhrizadeh had long been on Israel's hit list. This remark by the Israeli Prime Minister perhaps says it all.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
But this time around, Iran was quick to respond. Days ago, the country resumed enriching uranium to 20% purity, surpassing the 3.67% cap set by the 2015 nuclear deal.
While Tehran interprets the elimination of its nuclear scientists as nothing but an attempt to derail its nuclear program, the hunt for those culpable in Fakhrizadeh's assassination is placing the remaining pieces of the puzzle, which observers say is giving stronger clues of an Israeli link to the issue. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An official ceremony was held at the Assad House for Art and Culture in Damascus, marking the first martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Syria delivered a word condemning the assassination crime and asserting that the Iranian people have taken revenge and continue to do so. He also reiterated his country's ongoing support to the Syrian people and army until the full defeat of terror.
The criminal act perpetrated by the U.S. administration is against all international laws and the U.N. Charter. It is an act rejected by the entire world. The assassination proves the failure of the aggressive plot aimed at supporting terrorism and spreading instability in this region.
The event was attended by a wide range of high-ranking officials. Dr. Boutaina Shaban, who was representing Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in the ceremony, said the U.S. assassinated General Soleimani out of fear of his successful strategy that undermined their plots in the region, stressing Syrians will learn many lessons from the general's life. On the sideline of the ceremony, an exhibition was held shedding light on General Soleimani's life and focusing on his achievements in the fight against terror in Syria and Iraq in the past decade. A year after Lieutenant General Soleimani's assassination, Syrians are clearly keen to demonstrate their respect to his sacrifices for their country. Ceremonies held across the country express the high level of appreciation everyone here has for what the general had offered for the security of Syrian territories. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Following the landslide victory of Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party in last December's legislative election, former Information Minister Jorge Rodriguez has now been appointed as the new Speaker of the Nation's Congress, also known as National Assembly. Rodriguez, who is widely regarded as one of President Nicolas Maduro's closest allies, has claimed that the newly elected Congress will work exhaustively to promote the policies of the country's president. The assumption of Rodriguez as head of parliament puts an end to a five-year-long control of the congressional body by the opposition, through which the spat between the executive and the legislative produced political turmoil in the Latin American Republic. Socialist lawmakers praised the designation of Rodriguez. Although in the opposition, some complain about the new head of parliament. Nonetheless, experts believe that the new parliament is a politically balanced body now. Now that Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party has regained control of the country's Congress, many believe that President Maduro is more stable than ever in his office. While the opposition has hit bottom in political terms, Jesus Silva, Caracas.
Unemployment rates among Turkish youth have increased dramatically in the recent period, especially after the outbreak of the new coronavirus pandemic. According to the latest figures released by the Turkish Statistical Institute, the unemployment rate was 12.7% in September 2020. Turkish government says reviving economy is among its priorities amid the pandemic. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed not to allow foreign factors negatively affect the country's economy.
It is not possible for a state to survive in long term with rising unemployment, so we have developed various plans to revive our economy, turning it into one of the 10 largest economies in the world by equal distribution of wealth among our population.
As part of efforts to stop declining employment, the government has banned companies from firing employees during the pandemic. So it prevents us from seeing the direct effect of the coronavirus on unemployment. We cannot see it in numbers, but we can definitely see it on the ground. This is how economists explain.
Unemployment is one of the biggest economic problems in the world, and Turkey is no exception. Despite our government's projects to lower the unemployment rates, unfortunately the numbers are rising, especially amid the pandemic that has paralyzed the economic sector.
The government say it plans to lower the unemployment rate to 10.9% in 2023. However, it seems that it all depends on how the country plans to recover from a pandemic and the lira crisis. As observers say, the main strength point of the ruling party has been flourishing economy and low unemployment. And now, with the pandemic continuing more and more, the country is witnessing the ruling party's popularity sliding further. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Huge crowds from Damascus countryside flocked to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Held in eastern Ghouta, once a hub for terrorists, residents attended the ceremony to pay tribute as a sign of gratitude for General Soleimani's key role in defeating terror in Syria. Iran's ambassador to Syria condemned the heinous assassination crime, underlining the importance of unity of Muslims against the U.S. and Israeli plots in the region.
They assassinated General Soleimani in a coward way. The crime is against all international laws. They did that because their plans had failed in the region. The assassination only brought them shame and defeat, and will lead to their expulsion from the region.
Speakers praised the general's support to Syria as a key factor for restoring security to many parts of the Arab country.
We have gathered here to honor the memory of Commander Soleimani, who offered Syria valuable services. General Soleimani is a historic hero whose achievements changed the region.
A photograph exhibition was also organized to shed light on General Soleimani's achievements in Syria and Iraq. General Soleimani, assassinated by the U.S. a year ago in Iraq, headed Iranian military advisors in Syria at its government's request, and for years played a pivotal role in defeating terrorism and liberating many towns and villages. In Syria, the memory of General Soleimani reminds everyone of the principles of sacrifice, brotherhood, friendship, and unity. This is just one of many ceremonies held in Syria to commemorate the general and convey a message of respect and appreciation to all his achievements. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
The
The executive director of Yemen's petroleum company has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a over Saudi Arabia's blockade. The officials say the company lost over $100 million in 2020 due to the Saudi-led coalition violations and siege and accused the UN of complicity.
The United Nations is providing cover for the Saudi-led coalition's acts of piracy in international waters, and it bears full responsibility for them. The violations are huge, and the fines we have suffered are immense.
The senior official said nearly 24 petrol ships belonging to Yemen's petroleum company were confiscated by Saudi Arabia in 2020. He said the seizures came despite the fact that the ships all had transit permits from the UN. Yemen's petroleum company said the ships were released after a few months, but Saudi Arabia's quota acts of piracy cost them millions of dollars in delay fines.
The United Nations has become a clear partner in this blockade against the Yemeni people and has come to stand by the coalition of aggression, so it bears responsibility for the humanitarian crisis.
Yemeni officials say the confiscation of ships caused a spike in fuel prices and forced the closure of some services. They also say the delays and lack of fuel pushed the medical sector to collapse and caused a humanitarian crisis. Many people have to wait for days to get fuel for their vehicle and the limited number of petrol stations.
Saudi Arabia's blockade of Yemen has led to the deaths of Yemeni people and is pushing the country further toward what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This has taken place amid the silence of international organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washalif, Sana'a.
Saudi Arabia seems changing its diplomatic course with regard to neighboring Qatar as the years-long blockade by Riyadh and some of its allies failed to force Doha to bow to their demands. The Kuwaiti foreign minister announced a diplomatic breakthrough, saying Saudi Arabia has decided to reopen its air, land, and sea borders to Qatar.
Based on a suggestion of Sheikh Nawaf Al Ahmed Al Sabah, Emir of the state, an agreement has been reached for the reopening of land and sea borders between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the state of Qatar starting tonight.
Following the announcement, Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani accepted an invitation to attend a regional Arab summit in Saudi Arabia. Upon his arrival to the Saudi city of Al Ula, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman gave a warm welcome to Sheikh Tamim. In the summit, the leaders of the six-member Persian Gulf Cooperation Council signed a rapprochement agreement, although the details were not immediately released.
These efforts helped us reach the agreement of the Al-Ula statement that will be signed at this summit, where we affirm our Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability.
During the meeting, however, bin Salman missed no chance to repeat his anti-Iran rhetoric, describing Tehran's missile program as a threat to the region. But what actually had caused the conflict between Doha and Riyadh? In June 2017, Saudi Arabia, together with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. They cut ties and transport links with Qatar. Ironically, Saudi Arabia is accused of the same charges it has leveled against Qatar. Doha also repeatedly denied the allegations and said it was targeted because it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for the reconciliation. Qatar has not publicly bowed to any of the demands. Saudi Arabia has constantly pursued a policy of fueling regional tensions. Some of its allegations against Qatar even demonstrated Saudi hypocrisy, as the kingdom has long been engaged in regional conflicts. While its interference in Libya and Bahrain, as well as its anti-Iran rhetoric, is not hidden anymore, the kingdom's full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen has also exposed its hegemonic agenda. Undoubtedly, Riyadh's decision to ease the Qatar blockade proves the failure of its policy of siege and aggression. However, the credit goes to Doha that stood firm against what it called bullying by some Arab states, and so were the Qatari citizens who seemed galvanized by patriotic feelings.
These
Islamic Republic of Iran's army kicked off a maneuver that put to test hundreds of its domestically built unmanned aerial vehicles. The two-day military exercises saw the use of a variety of surveillance and reconnaissance drones, combat drones, bombers, and loitering munitions, which are known as suicide drones. As part of the drill, the Persian Gulf was simulated as the conflict zone, where the Iranian Army's Navy used the suicide drones to destroy their targets.
All of the four forces of the army took part in the drills by deploying their drones. Each force concentrated on their assigned missions. We at the Navy used a variety of our stealth drones that can fly deep into the enemy's waters and keep a close eye on their activities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's defense industry has been hit by U.S. arms embargoes for four decades. The sanctions have barred Iran from purchasing any foreign weapons, even from its closest allies. However, Iranian officials say the country's defense sector is up and running. The reason is the country has for all these years been developing its own arms based on domestic capabilities. And now drones are the epitome of Iran's advances in the defense industry.
In the field of UAVs, Iran is neck and neck with the few countries that have the technology. We began by producing surveillance UAVs, but today our unmanned aircraft can conduct combat missions as well. And we owe this achievement to US sanctions, because they forced us to rely on our domestic resources.
The Islamic Republic stepped into the field of UAV production around 2011 by reverse engineering American and Israeli drones it electronically commandeered or shot down. Tehran says today it is self-sufficient in designing, producing, and operating a range of UAVs with different applications.
In less than a decade, the term UAV grew from an alien word to a keyword in Iran's airspace. Still, the Iranian army says this is just the tip of the iceberg, and the greater part of Iran's defense capabilities is yet to be publicized.
The Prime Minister made the announcement Monday. The country will be going back to its 2020 mantra: stay home, protect the NHS, save lives. Boris Johnson warned there were going to be tough weeks ahead, but still offered a ray of hope.
The weeks ahead will be the hardest yet. But I really do believe that we're entering the last phase of the struggle, because with every jab that goes into our arms, we are tilting the odds against COVID and in favour of the British people. And thanks to the miracle of science, not only is the end in sight, but we know exactly how we will get there.
Some children across England had one day in school before the announcement was made, and people are vexed by yet another last-minute announcement. The opposition says the government is going to make mistakes, but to make the same mistakes again is unacceptable. But Boris Johnson insists the tier system was working and that the new variant of COVID-19 is what derailed it. The Prime Minister's remarks caused hashtags resign, school closures, and Boris has failed the UK to shoot to the top of the country's Twitter trending charts. He is accused of ignoring the science by insisting schools are safe. The third lockdown will be hard for families juggling work and school, but many companies in the leisure, retail and hospitality sectors feel they might not make it through to the spring. In response to these fears, the Chancellor of the Exchequer made an announcement Tuesday.
Well, in order to help support businesses through a difficult period through to the spring, today we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help. For businesses in the most affected sectors who are asked to close, they will receive up to £9,000 in a one-off cash grant. It's important to remember that comes on top of the existing monthly grant of £3,000 that those businesses receive, and the extension of furlough all the way through to April. You know, we remain committed to protecting jobs and supporting businesses.
The new COVID-19 restrictions come days after the UK and the EU reached a trade and security agreement as part of their Brexit divorce deal, and businesses in Britain had to start trading differently. They were dreading this, but now they say planning around COVID-19 restrictions has made the extra paperwork surrounding post-Brexit trade pale into insignificance. Bianca Rahimi, London.
This is
For a Better Life.
For a Better Life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program for a better life here on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about how to manage our lives. In the previous program, we talked about time management. In this program, I would like to speak more about financial management, which is also important. You might be surprised that Islam has talked about financial management. It has done so because it is a comprehensive way of life, and we have emphasized so many times in previous programs about this dimension of Islam, that Islam encompasses, embraces all the dimensions of human life, and one of them is to have financial management. It has done so because it is a comprehensive way of life. Islam expects its followers to plan their lives in such a way that they can live within their means and resources. For example, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, this pious servant of Allah, said, from the signs of a believer are three things. What are they? Number one, good management of livelihood. Number two, patience in the face of calamity. You have patience when something that bothers you, something that is very difficult for you to handle. In that situation, in that difficult situation which you face, if you can endure, if you can have patience in the face of calamity, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will open up other doors for you. Number three, the study of religion. So whatever job you have, whatever occupation you have, whatever you are occupied with, you should always put time to study your deen, your religion. It does not matter if you are an architect. You are, first of all and foremost, a Muslim architect. It doesn't matter if you are an economist. Doesn't matter if you are a doctor. Doesn't matter if you are a wall maker, a shoemaker. Whatever you are, whatever job you have, a time should be spent on knowing your religion, your deen. That is very, very important. The story of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam in the 12th chapter of the Noble Quran clearly portrays that one has to plan and manage the resources wisely. The king of Egypt saw a dream in which seven fat cattle were devouring seven lean ones. And he saw seven green ears and seven dry ones. Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam interpreted the king's dream, informing him that there would be 7 years of good harvest followed by 7 years of severe drought, and that he should conserve the first 7 years harvest for the next 7 years drought. Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam was given the charge of the treasury of the land, and he wisely managed the distribution as well as the storing of the grains during the first 7 years. And consequently, the country did not suffer hunger, and they could even help other countries and other regions outside Egypt. The problem of